From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court is expected any day to rule on a case involving abortion rights in the state of Louisiana, which could in turn have a profound impact on abortion access in at least 15 states nationwide, and could even chip away at the seminal Roe versus Wade ruling. It was nearly 50 years ago that the U.S. Supreme Court, at that time an all-male body, ruled 7-2 to legalize access to abortion. Many accounts have been written about the ruling and its impacts on women's reproductive rights. Now, as the concerted right-wing effort to overturn Roe v. Wade reaches today's Supreme Court, we'll turn to one of the nation's leading law experts on abortion who's just written a new book. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she specializes in the legal history of reproduction, the family, sexuality, and the Constitution. She teaches courses on torts, family law, employment law, and constitutional law. She's written three books about abortion, including After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, Beyond Abortion, Roe versus Wade, and the Fight for Privacy. She now joins me to discuss her latest book, Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Welcome to the program, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
So this particular account of a very, very important Supreme Court decision that has been perhaps more fought over than any other decision in modern day America, you write in your book, is uncovering a little discussed aspect of the story, which is some of those other discussions that went on that went beyond issues of morality and even went into issues of the cost to the nation, to individuals, the policy benefits. Why do you think this history needed to be told, this sort of untold history?
Well, I think if you look, for example, at the Louisiana case that's probably going to come down next month, a lot of listeners and viewers might get into that debate, because instead of talking about the right to choose or even a right to life, the Supreme Court is getting into these sort of esoteric questions about what Louisiana abortion access is like and what Louisiana medical care is like, that seem to have almost nothing to do with what we think about when we think about a right to choose abortion. And so I was curious about how we had gotten to this moment, and I wanted to kind of dig all the way to the beginning of that story. And what I learned is that the attacks on Roe v. Wade that I think are the most effective and the most concerted are no longer direct attacks, right? They're no longer really about what we think about when we think about a right to choose. Instead, they're arguments about what the reality of abortion in America is, whether that's for women or communities or families. And that as a result, if we're trying to understand both kind of where we are and where we might be going with abortion, we have to understand the nature of the attacks on Roe v. Wade and the nature of responses to those attacks. But really, for some time, we haven't been focusing on the more obvious kind of direct bans and the right to choose itself.
Right. There have been ways in which abortion opponents have attempted to restrict abortion so that it is, you know, banned earlier and earlier in the state of a pregnancy, or to force women to have to view an ultrasound or a waiting period, or simply to, I believe it's the case of Louisiana, doctors, the issue of whether doctors have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. So if these attacks are approaching the access of to abortion from these esoteric means, does that mean that the rulings have also, at various court levels, also been piecemeal and bit by bit?
It has, and it also means that they're, I think, harder to understand. So I think one of the things that makes challenging for people who follow this issue or who care about abortion as an issue is that it requires a lot more attention and a lot more care and probably a lot more reading to even understand what's going on. If the Supreme Court were in a couple of weeks to issue a decision saying, okay, Roe v. Wade is overturned, we would all know what that meant and there would be a backlash. If the Supreme Court instead says, this Louisiana law isn't unduly burdensome, which is a sort of buzzword that I trace in the book where that came from and what it means, that could have the same effect on lots of women, and not just in Louisiana or 15 other states, but nationwide. It would be a lot harder for the average voter to understand what was going on. And that's intentional, right? I mean, it's intentional on the part of abortion opponents who understand that what they want at the end of the day is to limit access to abortion by any means necessary. And it's also more likely in some ways for this Supreme Court, because we know already that several of the justices sort of in the middle, if you will, are concerned about the court's image and reputation as being a nonpartisan institution. So doing something that's more kind of under the radar or harder to understand is in some ways a much more likely way that we're going to see abortion rights unravel than the more kind of direct, transparent attacks that we might have become familiar with.
So let's get into the history. At the time when the Roe v. Wade decision was made, and this was based on a court, on a case that began, I believe it was in 1971. The ruling came a couple of years later at the highest levels of the Supreme Court. What were the arguments that opponents of abortion and then proponents of abortion made nearly 50 years ago? I imagine that they weren't the same as the arguments that are being made now, or were they?
Well, they were and they weren't. So fundamentally, right, what the anti-abortion movement believes and argues is that there's a right to life for an unborn child or fetus. And they root that right in the 14th Amendment, which came out of the Civil War, giving rights to free people of color, and in the Declaration of Independence. And that was what they argued in Roe. They argued that a fetus was a rights-holding person, and they argued that the right that states had a compelling interest in protecting life from the moment of conception. On the other hand, you had abortion rights supporters who were arguing that the right to privacy, which was connected to things like the right to marry and the right to use contraception, was broad enough to cover abortion. Now, all these arguments are still gone away, but they've kind of moved more to the margins of both political and constitutional debate. I think at the core, what people still care about hasn't changed, but what has changed is the sort of fundamental strategies that are being used both in American political life and also in the courts by both sides to get what they want. So if we're trying to kind of make sense of, you know, how much of a right to choose is there right now and how much will there be in a year or two, you need to understand the context and not just the sort of fundamental values that we're still contesting.
So what were the arguments that proponents of abortion made? I mean, the modern American woman, you know, of which I consider myself, thinks of a right to abortion as part of, you know, women's equality. Were those what the second wave feminists who backed abortion access, those the arguments that they made?
In part, yeah, there were arguments about women's equality, but the central argument in Roe, at least the second wave feminists who helped to litigate Roe, was more focused on privacy, in the sense more of autonomy, the ability to make a decision about important matters in your life for yourself. And the reason that that was the framework in part was because feminists were building on a series of Supreme Court decisions that were already out there in the 1970s that involved things like access to contraception or the right to have a child or the right to get married. So it was easier to kind of use those cases as a stepping stone toward abortion rights.
There's a sense that the Supreme Court in 1973 in making its decision for Roe v. Wade just went too far and provoked a backlash that, you know, whose results we are now seeing. Where do you stand on that? And does the history of what actually happened bear that out?
I mean, no. So I you can argue, certainly Roe v. Wade was a significant decision, but I think the backlash theory is problematic for a couple of reasons. Number one, the abortion conflict was heavily polarized before Roe. So Richard Nixon used abortion as a wedge issue before Roe came down. Anti-abortion organizations were very active in every state before Roe. So New York, for example, almost reinstituted an abortion ban because its anti-abortion movement was so active. So the idea that we would somehow not have had a bitter, ugly abortion debate without Roe doesn't seem very likely if you look at what was happening before. Secondly, immediately after Roe, things were actually a little bit less bad than they would become later. Not when it came to abortion directly, but when it came to issues like birth control, or discrimination against pregnant workers, there were actually compromises between anti-abortion folks and pro-choice folks for the better part of a decade after Roe. So when that changed, it wasn't really a function of Roe itself. It was more a function of things like Republicans using abortion as a kind of cudgel against Democrats and the rise of the religious right. Then finally, I think things have gotten much worse in recent decades, which is something I talk a lot about in the book, in part because on the right and the left, there's no longer an agreement on what the facts are. We've seen this, you know, vengeance when it comes to Donald Trump, but it's very much been true in the abortion debate that abortion opponents draw on different sources of expertise, different sources of data, different media outlets, and they disagree on basic information like whether abortion causes breast cancer or whether medication abortions are reversible. So now more than ever, we don't even agree on the kind of reality of abortion, much less on the moral or constitutional issues. So the idea that Roe is the only moving part in that story is, I mean, it would be great in a way if that was true, because then it would be much easier to solve the problem and move toward a kind of more rational approach to reproductive health. But I just don't think the history bears that out.
A huge aspect for argument against abortion or manner of chipping away at abortion rights from the right has been the idea that the government shouldn't be in the business of funding abortions. How effective has that strategy been? And is that playing any role in at least the state by state effort to chip away at abortion rights, but also the federal government's funding, Title X funding in particular? I know there's been a big issue around that.
Yeah, it was incredibly effective. In many ways, I think the strategy you see now, which has been a more state by state, death by a thousand cuts, began with the Hyde Amendment and began with the issue of abortion funding. And I think that when that happened, abortion opponents didn't even really know what they had. They didn't realize that they had a blueprint for a strategy that would take them forward decades toward really what looks like the demise of Roe. When the Hyde Amendment began, it was just a kind of opportunistic way to limit abortion by undercutting poorer women's access to Medicaid reimbursement. And that was true both in the states and the federal level. But what abortion opponents realized was, first of all, that there were lots of conservative Americans who were generally happy to kind of unravel the social safety net, regardless of the issue. And also that it was easier to get the Supreme Court and politicians on board with these more incremental restrictions than it was with a sort of sweeping criminal ban. So when, for example, abortion opponents have been trying to ban all abortions in the 70s, they got nowhere, but the Hyde Amendment passed and has been with us ever since. So a new strategy emerged, which was not to ask for an abortion ban, but instead to pass these sort of little restrictions, eliminate access, defend those restrictions in the Supreme Court, and then try to control who is on the Supreme Court by influencing both the White House and Congress.
Right. We know, of course, the last two Supreme Court justices that were appointed by Trump in particular are a big danger to abortion access, Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. And of course, all eyes are constantly on Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's seen as a bulwark against losing abortion access, and who, due to her seniority and time on the court and age and health problems, people are deeply concerned about losing her seat on the Supreme Court. Now, abortion itself as a medical procedure has also changed quite a bit in the years since Roe versus Wade, right? I mean, the ways in which abortion is conducted by abortion providers is that also something that's a fact that there's less agreement on today?
There is. I think the fact that's lent itself to or sparked more disagreement as new abortion techniques have emerged, that's both raised the possibility of more abortion access. I'm thinking particularly of medication abortions, which right. In theory could be taken via telemedicine or telehealth. And it's also multiplied the areas of disagreement. So whenever there's been a new promising abortion method that's come forward, abortion opponents have developed arguments about why that method is unsafe, either in general or without a physician's supervision. And so, for example, a new area of kind of confusion about the facts is medication abortion reversal. The American Medical Association right now is involved in a lawsuit arguing that laws that required women to hear information about the possibility of reversing abortions, that those laws are unconstitutional. And the AMA is saying that those laws are just inaccurate as a matter of medicine, and that research on this reversal technique either doesn't exist or has suggested that it's actually unsafe for patients. So as these new techniques have developed, it's made it even harder to have a kind of common ground conversation about best practices or about what's going on, because with each new technique, there have been new areas of disagreement that have cropped up.
Right. And anti-abortionists have also, of course, been part of the movement to restrict contraception in general. What about the way in which race enters into the conversation? You mentioned the 14th Amendment was seen as a basis for the pro-life movement. But of course, today's pro-life movement generally shares a big overlap with conservative white America that doesn't seem to care much about communities of color. But how have they used the rights of people of color to make arguments against abortion?
Yeah, that's actually been very common. One of the things, I think in recent years, we've seen the rise of a reproductive justice movement that's much more racially diverse. But historically, if you go back several decades, both really the anti-abortion and the pro-choice movement were predominantly white. The anti-abortion movement from the very beginning, though, framed itself sort of as a successor to the civil rights movement or even to the abolition movement, comparing fetuses to slaves, or to civil rights protesters. And there have been recent iterations of that argument that focus on the fact that women of color, particularly Black women, have disproportionately high abortion rates. And anti-abortion activists argue that that's not because women of color have fewer opportunities and therefore might be ending pregnancies by virtue of a lack of opportunity. They frame it as simply a function of predatory practices by abortion providers, right? The idea that Planned Parenthood is somehow connected to racism and eugenics. We saw this actually at the highest levels of our government in last year when Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion arguing essentially that Planned Parenthood and abortion providers generally, and even women having abortions, often had eugenic motives. So these idea, the idea that having an abortion or performing an abortion is somehow motivated by racism is a quite common anti-abortion argument.
So the arguments around abortion that seem to have been more effective, going back to the fact that state by state, they've chipped away at this right. They've also, of course, effectively through those state abortion restrictions pushed the issue to the Supreme Court, right? So instead of, they've almost given up on having Congress overturn the right. And it's been, if since the Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade, let's use the Supreme Court itself to overturn Roe v. Wade. It has been a quite effective strategy, unfortunately.
It has, and I think it's effective, as I mentioned before, because it's a little bit hard to understand what's going on. It's also because in America now, people who are divided by partisan politics don't agree on the facts. And we see that, you know, completely clearly during the pandemic, when people disagree about things as basic as the need to wear a mask or whether herd immunity is possible, right? Or whether there should be stay-at-home orders. When we don't, and I think that kind of ambiguity about the facts was something that abortion opponents used very effectively and in a very sophisticated way in the Supreme Court. So for example, in the Louisiana case that's before the justices now, the argument is not that there is no right to abortion. The argument instead is that Louisiana is different from Texas, where the Supreme Court struck down an identical law just 4 years ago. And the argument is also an argument about what abortion providers are like. So Louisiana is saying abortion providers can't sue or shouldn't be allowed to sue because they're not looking out for women. This is the fox guarding the hen house, which gets into arguments about is abortion good or bad for women? Are abortion providers good doctors or profiteers? And the more we get into these kind of what feel like questions about minutia or facts, the easier it is to generate confusion and uncertainty. And in that uncertainty is where you see the court unraveling these rights.
Do you expect the court to come down on the side of the anti-abortionists in this Louisiana case? And if it does, what does that mean for the future of abortion access in America?
Yeah, I think it depends. This case is a tricky case in some ways because John Roberts, who's viewed as the swing vote here, the Chief Justice, wants to appear as if he cares about precedent, right? That doesn't mean that abortion rights are safe. They're not. It's just whether John Roberts will literally overrule a case that was decided 4 years ago and still claim to care about precedent. That's the question. I think it's unpredictable which way he's going to go on this case. That said, I think it's pretty much a sure thing that the Supreme Court is going to start to retreat from abortion rights in a more forceful way. It's a matter of how and when. If it's with this Louisiana case, what it will mean for abortion rights will depend on which of three paths the court takes. The court could say, just uphold the Louisiana law without, in a very narrow way, which would, of course, kind of green light similar restrictions in other states, as you mentioned. The court could overturn its 2016 decision, which struck down an identical law, which would send a pretty powerful message about what the court thinks about abortion precedents more generally, including Roe v. Wade. Or it could hold that abortion providers can no longer bring lawsuits to challenge abortion restrictions, which would make it much, much harder for anyone to challenge abortion restrictions. And it would also suggest that the court is willing to buy this argument that abortion hurts women, which is one of the central arguments in anti-abortion reversal strategies.
Well, we'll certainly see how it all plays out. Mary, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Mary Ziegler, a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she specializes in the legal history of reproduction and other issues. She's written three books about abortion, including After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade, and The Fight for Privacy. We've been discussing her third and latest book, Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Are you with Sonali?